From the football gridiron to the opera stage, bass Morris Robinson has performed in many fields. He was an All-American offensive lineman at the Citadel, but these days he's been tackling some of the greatest opera roles in stages all over the world. And he's making his New York recital debut tomorrow night at the Metropolitan Museum of Art with a program ranging from Mozart to Bernstein, from arias to spirituals. I'm very pleased to welcome Morris Robinson back to the show. Hi, it's a pleasure to see you again.
Great to be here.
Now, I just wonder, because you've been just holding back a little bit of a cough there, what happens when a singer has that, gets a little sick? I know whenever I have a cough, whenever my nose gets stuffed up, I always think, gee, this is the voice I've always wanted. My voice gets a little deeper, sounding more resonant. Maybe it's just that my ears are clogged up.
Yeah, well, you know.
In your case, can the voice get much deeper?
Well, the voice doesn't get deeper. In fact, I lose my low notes when I get sick. It's mostly because, you know, things get caught in your throat and they coat your vocal cords. But when you get sick, I mean, the object of the game first is not to. Second of all, you would like to have enough technique after being in the rehearsal studios and the voice studios where you know how to overcome certain things. And then there are some times when things just, you know, you just can't go. I've been fortunate enough to only have had to cancel once in my life. So, you know, that football mentality, if it ain't broke, you know, you can still play on it type deal. So you try to fight through it.
Do basses get hoarse in the same way that sopranos get hoarse?
Well, I think it affects us differently. I think that basses lose their low. It depends on what's wrong with you as well. I mean, if you have a sore throat because you have a cold, your voice probably does get deeper. If you have this post-nasal drip sinus thing happening, they get coated with things and, you know, the cords don't vibrate as they should. So it's always, especially in weather like now when the temperature's up and down and you're in different atmospheres all the time, it's a... you know, going from place to place, you're more susceptible to that.
Now, much has been made of the fact that you played football and you're an opera singer. They don't seem like two things that have a real connection. But are there similarities between studying a football playbook and in X's and O's and an operatic score in Italian?
Yeah, I think so. I think that I always say that, you know, football is 90% mental. You know,
especially if you're an offensive lineman, they say that's the position that requires the most intelligence.
Well, of course, you have to know blocking schemes. You have to know every single play inside and out. You have to know what everyone's doing around you so you can do your job. And it's kind of like that in opera. I mean, you need to know what the other characters are saying. You need to know what the other characters are doing. You need to know why they feel a certain way and why you have to react a certain way. So, you know, it's all part of being part of the team. And I look at being part of a cast as being part of a team. You have to carry your weight. You have to do your job, but your job also depends on other people, and other people do their job depending on you. So it requires that you, you're very familiar with every aspect of the show.
What about just the physical training part of the whole thing?
Well, I think that is attributed to the discipline in both fields, if you will. I mean, there's a certain amount of discipline as an athlete. You have to take care of your body. You have to work out. You have to make sure that you're persistent in staying in shape. Same thing with being a singer. I think that, I go see my voice teacher as often as I can because even though I'm out and having a career now, you still have to make sure you take care of the basics. You know, you have to have another set of ears listen to you and tell you whether or not you're doing the right thing. You want to make sure that, you know, you keep yourself in vocal shape so you can always go.
In the same way, I'm sure that your line coach said to you, Marissa, you're not standing the way you should, and you thought you knew the job.
Coach, I've run this trap play a million times. I know how to do it. Well, you're taking a bad first step. That's why you're not getting there soon enough. Well, you've sung this aria a million times, but if you open this vowel up and cover it here and do this, it'll be easier for you, you know.
Now, you're not the first African-American singer who was a former football player. Paul Robeson preceded you. I've wondered about that. That's just coincidental.
Well, you know, of course it is, I guess. Oh, you know, I think that... I always say that the only similarities that we don't have is that he was a Rhodes Scholar and I wasn't. So, but I mean, even the last names are very similar. I didn't come into this world because of him, but I certainly discovered him since being here and look up to him quite a bit because, you know, here's a guy that, you know, in the 1920s was doing something unheard of by African-American men and was quite successful with it. And not obviously at the international stage level for opera, but he made a wonderful career for himself.
Well, in contemporary opera, there are any number of African-American women who've done very well, and they have for over the past 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
But we haven't heard about too many men doing well. Is there some reason for that?
I think that exposure breeds familiarity. And I think that, you know, I wasn't exposed to this art form at an early age, and it's not very common that we are. I mean, in the African-American community, it's sad to say that, you know, classical music isn't high on the priority list. You know, you're inundated with the VH1s, the MTVs, those types of things. You see R&B, you see hip-hop, you see athletics as being an escape route, if you will, to get into the real world. And, you know, on a lesser degree, there's business opportunities. You see entrepreneurs, you see doctors and lawyers, but you don't see classical singers. And of course, you don't see them that look like yourself, so you really don't look at that as a viable opportunity. It isn't until recently, and obviously for me being involved with it, I know more, but, you know, there's people like Larry Brownlee, people like myself, Kevin Short, you know, guys that are out doing it now. And I have a 3-year-old son who grows up with all these people. He knows Uncle Russell. He knows Uncle Larry. He sees his dad. And, you know, I think it's just the familiarity of letting them know that this also is a viable opportunity. I mean, there's plenty of talent in the African-American community. There's plenty of talent, but not tapped into by this marketplace. So,
well, one of the cliches of African-American singers is, oh, I got started singing in the church.
Yep.
And in your case, your father and grandfather were ministers, weren't they?
Baptist ministers.
So did you start singing in church?
I did. My first solo was, I was 6 years old, and there was a James Cleveland song called Can't Nobody Do You Like Jesus. And I had to stand in the chair because they couldn't see me behind the choir stand. And I had to sing. That was my first solo.
You were a soprano then.
I was a soprano. I ended up actually being the church drummer, though. So I was always around music, but I played the drums. My sisters, my mom and dad, they were the singers. I always tell people I was like the fifth best singer in my household. You know, I still am. You know, I just so happen to do something different.
Well, James Cleveland had a bass baritone voice. You could have gone in that direction, too.
Probably so. I think that, you know, my voice is more suited, actually, for this type of music, though. I don't think I'd be a very good gospel singer. I don't have the riffs. I don't have the runs. I don't have those things that are, you know, that are part of that culture, if you will.
So when did you learn? When did you come in contact with opera?
Opera, not until 30. Classical music, I started...
Until you were 30 years old?
I started studying at 30. Yeah.
Well, a lot of opera singers actually come to it a little later simply because the voice, you know, it's like going on your toes. If you're a ballet dancer, when you're too young, you're actually building up some of the wrong muscles. Many opera singers have told me that they didn't hit their stride until their late 20s.
Well, I think there's also the fear of burnout. I mean, you can start early and then, you know, you can have enough of it by then. And I think starting at the late age was advantageous for me for a few reasons. First of all, I was mature. I was ready to do something different, and I had a mature approach into how I had to be disciplined to learn. The second part was my voice was ready for it. You know, I didn't do so much singing and so much damage to it early on that it shown up later. So
is it true that you were actually in the first opera you ever saw?
I was in the first opera I ever saw. That was in October of 1999, Aida at Boston Lyric Opera, singing The King and Aida. Yeah.
So you were in rehearsals. You finally saw what an opera was like.
Well, I didn't really see what it was like until we did the final dress rehearsal, and I was standing on stage with costume, and I thought to myself, I was like, wow, so this is okay, this is pretty cool. Right before my opening line, it was actually a really cool place to be in, because I wasn't really aware of all the pressure involved. I just knew that I could do this. I could sing, and that's kind of what I did. So.
There's also acting.
Well, you know, there's acting also. But, I mean, you learn those things throughout the process. You become more familiar with it. And as I mentioned before, knowing what every character does and every character sings, it's like drinking water out of a fire hydrant at that age. You're trying to get so much in at once. And I'm a lot more comfortable now than I was, you know, 8 years ago. So
you said before you did this at the age of 30, you were singing classical music, mostly lieder, I guess?
No. I sang in high school. I went to a high school of performing arts. And we did, my junior year, we did the Mozart Requiem. My senior year, we did Haydn's Creation. And those were my two exposures, if you will, to classical music. After that, it was the National Anthem and the Lord's Prayer at National Anthem at sports events and the Lord's Prayer at lots of weddings. So
because football intervened. And did were you able to, obviously you weren't able to keep both going at the same time. You say that you pretty much devoted the rest of your energy to football.
Well, at the Citadel, I took a football scholarship after high school.
Could you have taken, what would happen if they had offered music scholarships? Might you have taken one?
Probably not. All the cool guys were knocking people out on the football field, and they had all the girlfriends, and that was pretty much my motivation. Plus, I mean, being from the South, big guy, you have to play football. It's not even an option. The coach sees you walking down the hallway, he drags you out to practice that day. So,
how come you're not out on the field?
Exactly. You should be out here hurting people. So I was in the band, actually, my freshman year, and I wanted to be on the football field. So I had to quit the band and join the chorus to fulfill my music obligations because I was at the School of the Arts. So I quit the band, joined the chorus in order to play football. So,
and was it your fantasy that you someday go on to play professional football?
Of course, yeah. Didn't work out for me. I think I always tell people football left me. I didn't leave football, but it certainly was a long-term goal of mine. Of course, going to the Citadel, there's a certain amount of reality that you know that you're not playing at Notre Dame, so the chances are very slim. But of course, every kid that plays at the collegiate level and has a pretty decent career has some dreams of going on.
You tell a story about how singing choral music actually allowed you to pursue your football interests in high school.
Well, that's what I'm back to the story. I was in the marching band, and at the first football game in the marching band, I realized that I wanted to be on the football field. So I had to join the chorus in order to fulfill my obligations to the School of the Arts, and that allowed me to play football that spring. So
you released your debut. First of all, I've been remiss. I haven't told people once again that I'm talking with Maurice Robinson, who has been, I'm sure you're booked up right now into the year 2012 or something like that, because opera singers often are committed to playing roles way into the future.
It's a happy problem. You certainly, and if you're blessed and fortunate enough in this business, you get opportunities. So maybe not to 2012, but certainly to 2011, at least I know of. So,
and tomorrow, and you're going to be at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in that wonderful space that they have, where you could probably be seeing something from Aida, because there's a big temple right there.
I think so. Yeah, I'm not familiar with the space. I will be tomorrow by the first rehearsal with Ken. So, I'm looking forward to it. I'm very excited about this.
But what will you be singing?
I'm starting off with a Mozart concert aria, Mentre ti lascio. Then I go to Schubert, Der Doppelgänger. Then I do some excerpts from the Wolf's Michelangelo Lieder, followed by two opera arias, one from Verdi, one from Mozart. And then after the break, I go into the Take Your Bow Tie Off section, where you're singing more American songs.
And that's what you put on your debut album last year, Going Home.
Well, Going Home is actually a compilation of religious and gospel songs. I may be doing one of those pieces at the end, but the things I'm doing in the second half, John Jacob Niles, Bernstein, Margaret Bonds, traditional spirituals, Wendell Whalum, that type of stuff.
And when you're singing opera, is something different going through your head than when you're singing religious music? Because you did grow up in the church.
I think that you become involved in the moment of everything that you're doing. And that, that comes with artistic maturity as well. But when you're on the operatic stage, you're part of a character, you're part of a cast, you're part of a story, so you naturally have to be involved in that. If you're thinking about what the score of the game is and you're out there singing, Fozzel, you're in trouble, because it's just not a good place to be.
You told Chavis Smiley that his Eyes on the Sparrow had special significance for you.
Yeah, that was my mother's favorite song. And I ended up singing it at her funeral, which came up.
You're not very sparrow-like. You're a big guy. It wouldn't take much for him to watch over you.
Well, it's a very touching song. I sing because I'm happy. I sing because I'm free. His Eyes on the Sparrow, I know he watches over me. I sang that at my mother's funeral, and it was a very trying time for me because it happened all of a sudden. I was in rehearsals at the Met for Zalame, and I walked out the building and I found out my mom had just passed away, like unexpectedly, because I talked to her the night before. So I had to zoom to Atlanta, cancel all the rehearsals, take care of the funeral arrangements. I sang that song at her funeral, and I wanted to make sure that was on my first album. So,
Maurice Robinson will be giving his New York recital debut tomorrow at 8 p.m. at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. For ticket information, you can visit the Leonard LoPage show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
Going home, going home, Lord, I'm going home. Going home, going home, Lord, I'm going home. No more trials, no more cares, no more grief to bear.